Well, let us turn in our Bibles to that passage we read a few minutes ago, Luke chapter 19, beginning at verse 11. In the run-up to the Trump-Putin summit last Friday, one commentator noted how President Trump was clearly and deliberately managing expectations of what would be accomplished on that occasion. Rather than saying that he was going to end the war there and then on Friday, which is the sort of thing he said during the election campaign, he was instead saying that Friday's meeting would be more like the setting of the table to allow for future discussions between Russia and Ukraine to take place around the table. And with the hindsight of just a couple of days, we would have to say that it was wise of him to manage expectations in that way. Otherwise, his meeting with Mr. Putin would have gone down in history as being a complete failure. That is the wisdom in managing expectations, and it's something that's wise to do in all sorts of situations. For example, young people who are waiting on exam results but not very sure how they have done, they're wise to manage expectations, their own expectations and that of their parents. All 20 football managers who are commencing the new Premier League season this weekend, each one of them would love to win that competition, but they've learnt to manage expectations. Otherwise, 19 sets of players and 19 sets of spectators will be bitterly disappointed and disillusioned come the end of the season. That is the need to manage expectations. And as we come to verse 11 of Luke 19, we discover that that is what Jesus is doing here, which leads me to my first point, and that is in verses 11 to 12, and there we see a realistic understanding of God's kingdom. A realistic understanding of God's kingdom. Now, way back in chapter 9, verse 51 of this gospel, Luke begins a new section there in his historical account by telling us that as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And from that point in his gospel, Luke has been following Jesus on that final journey of his up to the capital city of Jerusalem. It's been a long journey, but the incident at the start of chapter 19 indicates that that journey is nearing its end, because you may remember that the incident with Zacchaeus took place in Jericho. And with Jericho being less than 20 miles from Jerusalem, that is an indication that Jesus' journey up to the capital is nearing its end. And we are told in verse 11, because he was near in Jerusalem, the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. Having read their Old Testament scriptures, the people of Israel were waiting for the coming of God's kingdom. And having started to think that Jesus might just possibly be God's messianic king, they assumed that his arrival in Jerusalem would see him crowned king and would see him establish God's kingdom on the earth. It was something they longed for, because as far as they were concerned, the kingdom of God was going to be primarily an earthly kingdom, a geographical kingdom, a political kingdom, a kingdom that would overthrow the oppressive foreign rule of the Romans once and for all and enable them to live in peace once again. And consequently, as Jesus nears Jerusalem, there is great excitement and there are huge expectations. As we are told in verse 11, expectations that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. And that is why by the time we get to verses 37 and 38 of this chapter, we read of Jesus finally entering Jerusalem, and there is great excitement. There is great hype surrounding his arrival, with the crowds calling out the words of Psalm 118, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." But their understanding of God's kingdom was wrong, and therefore their expectations on this occasion were mistaken. And it was in order to correct their understanding and manage their expectations that Jesus told them this parable, verse 12. A man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. Now, having watched Prince Charles become King Charles a couple of years ago, it might surprise you to hear Jesus use the illustration of a man going to a distant country in order to be appointed king. If you think about it, that would be equivalent to Prince Charles travelling to India or China or somewhere like that and then returning as King Charles. But for first century Jews, it wasn't such a strange illustration. They were living under Roman occupation, and when the Herod or whoever died, the person who was lined up to take his position next had to travel all the way to Rome to be approved and to be appointed as king by the emperor in Rome. And so to a first century Jewish audience, the illustration would have been a familiar one. But if we are going to understand this parable, then we need to understand that Jesus is telling this story as an illustration about himself. It is he who will go to a distant country and be appointed king and then return. And what was that distant country? Well, don't forget that Luke 9 verse 51 tells us that it was as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven that Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And so the purpose of Jesus telling this parable was to teach those people back then, rather than him being publicly crowned king on his arrival in Jerusalem within the next few days and establishing the kingdom of God in all its fullness there and then, Jesus would instead return to heaven first. And it would be there that he was appointed as king. And then at some later stage, he would return to this earth to implement his earthly rule and establish the kingdom of God in all its fullness. That was a much more realistic understanding of God's kingdom, and it's an understanding of God's kingdom that was validated by the subsequent events of history. You see, although the crowds were ecstatic in verses 37 and 38 and are shouting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord," by the time you get to chapter 23, verse 21, there is once again a crowd assembled in Jerusalem. And they're shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And it is that crowd that Pilate listens to and then sentences Jesus to death. And his death upon the cross left those who were expecting the kingdom of God to come at once. His death upon the cross left those people completely confused, because their understanding of the kingdom could not accommodate the crucifixion of the king. You see, rather than establishing a political or a geographical kingdom, Jesus had come to this earth to inaugurate a different kind of kingdom. He had come to inaugurate a heavenly kingdom, which rather than consisting of people of one nationality, it would consist of all those throughout our world And this is who the kingdom of God consists of. It would consist of all those throughout our world who acknowledge Jesus to be king, and in doing so submit to his kingly authority within their lives. And the way in which Jesus would populate his kingdom was by going to the cross and in his death pay the price of his people's redemption, the price of their deliverance from the dominion, from another kingdom, from the dominion of darkness, because as Paul says in Colossians 1 verse 13, he has delivered us from the kingdom of darkness so that we might be brought from that kingdom into the kingdom of the Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And so, far from denying the messianic kingship of Jesus, and far from contradicting his role in the establishing of God's kingdom, as most within first century Israel thought, his death upon the cross was evident that he was indeed the messianic king that he had claimed to be, and his death upon the cross was vital to the establishing and the populating of his kingdom. And having died on the cross, and having been buried, he rose again the third day. And on his return to heaven, he was, as Peter tells us in Acts 2, verse 36, he was declared by God to be both Lord and Christ. It was on his return to that distant land, to use the words of Jesus' illustration in verse 12, it was on his return to that distant land that his coronation as king took place. It was then that he was divinely recognized and divinely declared to be king. And as Jesus tells us in the little story, there is coming a day when, like the man in the story, King Jesus will return in all his glory to implement his divine rule and exercise his kingly authority. That is a realistic understanding of God's kingdom, and it's vitally important that we understand it, because if we want to be citizens of that kingdom, then we need to acknowledge and submit to the kingship of Jesus Christ now, while there is the opportunity to do so, because as we'll discover in the story, when he returns, it will be too late. And so it's vitally important that we submit to the kingship of Jesus Christ now, while there is the opportunity to do so. Which leads me to my second point, verses 13 to 19, and that is the privilege of serving in God's kingdom. The privilege of serving in God's kingdom. Now, prior to leaving for that distant land, the future king in Jesus' little story called 10 of his servants in and gave them 10 minas, one mina each. A mina being worth about 3 months' wages, and so if you calculate that even at minimum wage, that would be around £6,500 in today's money. And his instruction to those servants was this, verse 13, put this money to work until I come back. Now, before going on to tell us what those servants did with the money, Jesus tells us in verse 14 about some within that society who had no time whatsoever for this future king. Did you notice that? The thought of him becoming king and reigning over them was such a bad prospect in their estimation that they sent a delegation after him to say to the person who was going to appoint him as king, to say, we don't want this man to be our king. And again, that was an illustration that people back then could relate to. I say that because apparently when Herod the Great died approximately 30 years earlier and his son Archelaus was heir to the throne, a delegation of Jewish people travelled all the way to Rome to protest against his appointment as king due to a massacre under his supervision, his reputation amongst the Jewish population was so bad that they could not bear to think of him becoming king. And so they made all the journey. Oh, you can imagine in those days, going from Jerusalem to Rome, what a journey. And yet they made that journey. And yet their protest was all in vain. The emperor appointed Archelaus, and he reigned in Judea for the next 10 years. And likewise, the protest of this delegation in the story was all in vain, because verse 15 tells us he was made king, however, and returned home. It's a reminder that unlike our democratically elected MPs, kings are usually appointed regardless of public opinion. Have you noticed that? That was true of this king in the story. And it's also true of King Jesus. In response to the public's demand to have Jesus crucified, which I quoted a few minutes ago, Pilate asked the question, "Shall I crucify your king?" And in response, the chief priests in Jerusalem said this. They said, "We have no king but Caesar." However much they despised Roman rule, the last thing they wanted was the rule of King Jesus. That was true of many people back then, and it continues to be true of many people today. They would rather give their love and their loyalty and their allegiance in life to anything and anyone other than Jesus. The thought of Jesus being king and having the right to say what they can and cannot do in life is a non-starter as far as they are concerned. And it may just be that that is your attitude towards Jesus this morning. You appreciate your independence and your autonomy too much. You like to be master or king of your own life. And the thought of giving that place of supreme authority in your life to anyone else, and especially to Jesus, is